Do you want to do a special episode?
Hey, yeah, let's do a special episode. Welcome, everyone, to the Ribbon Book Club, a Dear America podcast. My name is Jen.
I'm Kate.
And we are here still talking about the Irish potato famine.
So specifically, we're discussing the book Black Potatoes, the story of the Great Irish Famine from 1845 to 1850 by Susan Campbell Bartoletti. Susan has been kind enough to join us today. Would you please say hello?
Hi.
Thank you so much for being with us. We should tell the story of how Kate reached out to you, because it's funny to me.
So when I got Black Potatoes, I fell in love with it very quickly because it was telling some real history. It was not covering stuff up or making it nice and tidy. It talked about the ugliness of slow deaths and how colonialism impacted the Irish people. And so I had to find you online, and I just wanted, like, I was like, let's get a look at this warlock. Who am I dealing with? And then I found your website, and I was like, I love her. And so I decided to write you a letter using your P.O. box that you very kindly put on your website. And I effectively went through all of my I have a very large stationery collection, and I was like, what stationery do I think she'd like? And I tried to pick out something that I thought you'd appreciate, and I wrote a fan letter.
Yes.
And I was like, just, you know, like, just shot my shot. Hey, if you ever have a chance or are interested at all in appearing in our podcast, here's what it's called. Here's how to reach me. Love, Kate Reed. And you very kindly reached out just a few weeks ago, and
calm yourself.
Okay.
But we are very grateful that you agreed to be on our show. So do you want to kind of introduce yourself and tell us a little bit how you got started?
Do you want to read her bio?
You went right past that
You
part.
Have to cut me off sometime, no, boo.
Okay, so to give a more formal bio.
Thank you.
our guest, she is a multi-talented writer. She's published poetry, short stories, picture books, novels, nonfiction for young readers. She is a Newbery Award winner. She has the Siebert Award for nonfiction, among many other honors. She has picture books and novels, which includes The Boy Who Dared and books for the Dear America series, which we will be revisiting at a later date, and including one of my all-time favorites of the series, The Coal Miner's Bride, which I
when I told Jen that you were a Dear America author, she's like, well, which titles? And I said that one.
And
Jen
gasped.
Stood in my kitchen and about screamed.
I love a grim, realistic, gritty telling of a Polish immigrant who has to marry a coal miner. So, yeah, we have, and then there's several nonfiction books about, you know, World War II and Hitler and all. Like, so you have so many different areas that you have written about. You co-edited a nonfiction anthology, and you have a PhD in English from Binghamton University. And as you were telling us earlier, you used to teach. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me. I love talking about books, and I love talking about writing. And so it's really fun to be here. You know, I wasn't one of those people who knew she wanted to be a writer, you know, from a very young age. I always enjoyed writing. I always enjoyed reading. I loved reading. And I always enjoyed art. And so if you were to ask me when I was a child what I was going to be when I grew up, I would have said, oh, I'm going to have my own comic strip.
Oh, wonderful.
That's what I'm cool. going to do. That's what I'm going to do. And so when I went off to college, well, let me back up and just say, when I was in high school, I had a we had a very strict English teacher, our advanced section, you know, we third period every day, and she was a battleship of a woman. She would just navigate our classroom like a man of war. And she is the one who assigned the research paper. And you know, I tell writers today, if you want to write a nonfiction book, a full-length nonfiction book, if you've written a research paper, you already know everything you need to know in order to write and craft a nonfiction story. And even a historical fiction story, you already know. And so that was the best lesson that I ever gleaned out of high school. It was so much better than algebra and, you know, geometry and parallelograms and, you know, all of that. It was like just the greatest lesson. And so when I went off to college, of course, we had lots more research papers. And I had a wonderful creative writing professor by the name of Barbara Hoffman. Actually, I had wonderful English professors in college who really saw something in me as a writer that I didn't even see in myself at the time. Marion Thier, Mary Hart. I'm still in touch with Mary Hart even today. And I had a wonderful creative writing professor, Barbara Hoffman, and who just encouraged me and encouraged my work. But when I, you know, decided I was going to be an English major, it was really like, well, what are you going to do with that?
The classic conundrum.
Yeah. And, you know, I became an English teacher and I landed a job teaching eighth grade as soon as I graduated. I never thought I was going to teach eighth grade. If I taught anything, I thought it would be high school. Mm-hmm. But there's something about the middle school student. Mm. It's like the middle child, you know? There's something.
Nobody
about,
wants to work with them, but they're geniuses.
I love them. They're interested in everything for exactly 20 minutes.
Mm. And then they're critically bored.
Wow.
And very critical of you.
Oh, yes.
And so I my joke is that, you know, that I got them, they got me. Mm. I got their humor, they got my humor, you know, they completed me.
Mm. I love that.
It's wonderful.
And so I assigned, you know, a lot of writing. They wrote poetry, and some of my students even were published as eighth graders.
Amazing.
They wrote stories. They wrote essays. They wrote nonfiction, picture books. They wrote, and they were having fun, or at least seemed to me as though they were having fun. But what they didn't know is that as they were doing all that writing, I was doing every assignment that I made them do. I never believed in making a student do anything that I wasn't willing to do myself. And so, you know, I would also write. They would bring their work into class and we became like a big workshop. Mm. Every once in a while, I'd have to screw up my nerve and I would bring us maybe something I had written into class. Mm. Oh, they were so good. They were really good critiquers. And that's how I discovered my voice, my audience, and even my subject matter, because though, you know, those are the three discoveries that every writer must make. And you know, it's not like we have one voice; we have many voices, and we shift gears as we're talking to different people. And you know, as we create the characters or decide on the narrative voice for a particular nonfiction book, we're also doing that gear shift. And so it became I'm not a competitive person with other people, but I'm very competitive with myself. It's a self-competition. And so I thought, well, maybe I can get something published. And so I began sending out these little stories to Highlights for Children. Mm-hmm. And that was my first sale, was Highlights for Children.
Do you remember the year? I was an avid cover-to-cover Highlights girl.
It had been like 1989 it came out.
Oh, okay. So a little TD, like I was 93, 94.
Okay. I don't know when my last story came out. It was later than that. I had won their fiction contest. They, you know, bought a couple stories from me. And the very first story that I sold, I got paid $225.
Oh, nice.
And I bought myself a gold bracelet.
Nice. That's a good investment.
I believe in investing in yourself. And I don't.
Yes.
I'll get to that in a minute. But that's like the one and only time that I ever spent money on something like that. But I wanted to remember that moment.
I bet you that felt like the most luxurious purchase, and like you won everything.
And so then you can say, well, what does Highlights for Children and Hitler Youth have in common?
A lot.
Well, when I won the Newbery Honor, I wore that gold bracelet to the dinner. And so, you know, it's a funny little, you know, connection there. So I wrote a couple of other, I then began writing longer works. And so, you know, I'd sold a picture book, then I sold another picture book, but then I sold a nonfiction book that was sort of like the breakout book of my career. And it was called Growing Up in Coal Country. And that was, the idea for that was, came from my husband's grandfather, who worked in the coal mines for 45 years.
Oh, wow.
Started as a child when he was 11. And then worked. And when my husband was in grad school, he interviewed his grandfather. And so, and then I went and I interviewed, you know, I collected these stories. I can't say I interviewed him for the book, but I collected his stories. I'm a big journal keeper. And so that became the groundwork for that book, Growing Up in Coal Country. And it, the teaching eighth grade helped to feed that book, because most books that talk about child labor focus on the fact that children were disenfranchised, victimized, exploited laborers, and that's all true. But from teaching, I also knew that kids will be kids whenever they can get away with it. And so when I was interviewing men for that book, a 94-year-old man named Richard Owens, you know, all these men in their 70s, 80s, 90s to tell me their stories. After they told me how hard they worked and how they learned to value a dollar and how, you know, the things in their childhood, I would say to them, okay, all right, what did you get away with that the bosses didn't know about?
Good question.
What a wonderful question.
Bring out everybody's scamp energy.
Yes. And so all the stories came out. And, you know, kids 150 years ago, 120 years ago, the same as kids today. You know, and the kids will be kids, as I said, whenever they can get away with it. And at the end of the school year, each year, I'd have a lot of kids, teachers would have their kids like survey or write an evaluation. Well, my evaluation consisted of questions like this. One, what should I teach again next year? You know, what projects, what assignments, what should I include? What shouldn't I include? And then question number three, what did you get away with that I didn't know about?
Make it fun.
Oh my goodness. And so what they would tell me, I was not the most strict teacher in the school. I mean, my classroom was, you know, was a tight classroom, but not that tight. You could breathe in my room, right? But then they would tell me about what they got away with in other classes. And I just, in one particular class, there was a teacher who assigned a lot of homework. And every night, a lot of homework, page after page. And so there were three best friends, three girls, who decided in the middle of this homework, rather than answer all the questions, they would copy Jell-O recipes. And they never got caught.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
My high school physics teacher had much the same problem, and we figured out that he wasn't reading the homework, because he would, I would get stuff that I didn't even try on. Like, I didn't even answer the question, and he would be like, yep, you got a C plus. And I'm like, horse hockey. So we started putting in lyrics. Dark they, Side of the Moon. And
kids can tell.
Awesome. Yeah.
That was, I couldn't believe, we went through the whole year like that. He never cottoned on. Two semesters. Ridiculous.
Kids are just amazing. Like, they can just nail a personality and so quickly. And, you know, they can suss things out. You just, you can't pull one over on them.
I agree, but many people still try. And everybody thinks kids have to be so coddled and protected. And we can't tell them ugly things. And that doesn't always lend itself well to being a student of history, because a lot of times appreciating history is looking at how awful and messed up it is. and making the connections from there to here, you know, the present day, so you have a better idea of how messed up our world is and where the systems are failing us and things like that.
And it helps really develop empathy in kids. I think what really struck me with you talking about your teaching experience, and first of all, I love that you would do the assignments and then also bring them in as like kind of a workshop. I bet your students loved that, because I could totally see as a preteen, you're just starting to become aware of like what being cool is and like social dynamics, and to have, you know, an adult who's, you know, your teacher to be, you know, being fairly vulnerable in like sharing their own creative work must have been so special to them. And also, it's striking me that I bet a lot of children's authors like would benefit hugely from spending a lot more time in the classroom to really get to know their audience like you did. It's probably
it's one thing to go in and speak and get it. Like I've been to schools in I think 42 different states now, and it's one thing to spend a day there or to have lunch with kids, but it really is another thing to get in there with them. And I want to pick up on a couple things you said, because about young people being coddled, one of my favorite old movies is a Cary Grant movie called The Bishop's Wife.
And I make Jen watch it every year.
Oh, it's so beautiful. And there's that
Susan, scene we're best friends now. I just want you to know that we're going to have to go get matching tattoos.
Okay. I want to get a number two pencil.
That's so rad.
Yeah.
I love that.
I figure it'll be, it'll start out as a stub. And as I get bigger, it'll get full grown.
I love that.
Fantastic.
Anyway, but The Bishop's Wife, there's that scene where Cary Grant, the woman is concerned that her daughter will get hurt.
Yes.
And he says, well, of course she'll get hurt, but she'll have fun.
Yes. In the snowball fight, it's the best.
Yeah. And I think about that because, you know, the story of our scars is far more interesting, emotional or physical scars. They're far more interesting than, you know, some of the other stories that we can tell.
Right. The more curated, a little tidier, more palatable to certain demographics.
Well, and letting kids experience the freedom of choice and the consequences of their, you know, like, you know, falling down and getting hurt, and you learn a lesson there. Like, that's
and there's fun.
There's
a comic online that it's got kind of like a Jack Skellington. It's a Santa Claus, but the head is a skull. And he hands a little girl a sword, and the parents are horrified, and they're like, oh my gosh, you know, what if she hurts herself? And Santa says, well, that will be a very good lesson then. It makes me laugh every year. I've probably reposted that 40 times.
That's a flesh wound.
Yes.
Oh.
So let's talk briefly about Black Potatoes. I am truly enamored with this book. I respect it so much. What, you know, with such a dark subject matter, why did you want to shine light on that subject as a nonfiction specifically, not just, you know, as a fictionized kind of step away from it, but as a nonfiction, this is truly what happened, and written in a way that kids aren't going to have to go back and unlearn what they learned from you years later? I think a lot of writers for children have become very comfortable with that lies my teacher told me setup. Where you have to kind of unlearn years later, like, that wasn't correct. You were so starkly real in this book. And I just, you know, how did you come up with that idea? How did you decide that that was the direction you were going to go in? I would just love to talk about the process of writing. I mean, feel free to monologue. I'm here to listen.
Okay. Well, I'm very interested in the stories of people, young or old, who have lived, the agency of people, who have lived through difficult times, some who have survived and some who have not. And so in that book, First of all, it was a subject that my editor said, "Hey, would you ever consider writing about this?" And I said, "Ooh, yeah." And so I was a graduate student at the time. I was in the doctoral program, and that book was my dissertation.
Did
But
you get your doctorate?
yes,
I'm sorry,
it's
Dr.
in the bio.
Bartoletti. Oh, well,
It's in the
I was not
bio.
paying attention.
That's
I got excited about the Dear
okay.
Americanist and I moved
Yeah.
on with my life. Well,
So
Dr. Bartoletti, you were saying.
I went to the library, and because in a book like it's always a you figure out where do I start the research, and then sometimes you're starting with the primary sources, the interviews, for instance, for like growing up in coal country, but in other cases, I might be starting with learning the history, finding the history, the standard works on the subject. So I'm like, okay, great. So I went to the library at Binghamton University, and I went to the Irish section. Well, my goodness, those people write a lot of books. The stacks, there were just rows and rows and rows and book of books on Irish history. And I can remember like having this panic attack, like, oh my God. Now what? And so, that's basically, I think the way or at least I begin every book, it feels like I'm in quicksand. And what I had to learn is you're not actually going to die in quicksand. It's very difficult because quicksand is, basically it's about 4 feet deep. But anyhow, that's another subject. And so, I
Wait, is
started with,
that true though? Is quicksand only like 4 feet deep?
it's not very deep at all.
You're
So,
blowing my
yeah.
mind.
And you're going to float because the upper part of your body is less dense because of lungs and everything, organs, than the lower part of your body. And so you're really not going to submerge.
Well, this
Okay.
is completely counterintuitive to every adventure television show I watched as a
Isn't
child.
it? Isn't it? Yeah. So that's what made me afraid of quicksand. But anyway, and so I located the standard works on the subject. And I got a grasp of the history, and I realized, like, wow, I've got to go to Ireland. I got to get these stories. And so I also needed to pass a language competency exam at Binghamton, and I already knew French, not enough to carry on a conversation, but to tra I could translate loosely. And so I thought, well, why not just learn a new language? And so I studied Irish for 2 years.
That is not the same as a little bit of French. That
What
is.
about just learn Irish?
Let me just flip
Listen,
everything I know about language on its
I've been on
ear.
Duolingo for years, and that has never been a thought that I've had.
Well, like French, I had like 12 undergrad credits in French. So, I believe that I could have done the language competency, but I decided I'm going to learn Irish, and I just loved my Irish teacher by the name of Kim Allen. And so then I went to Ireland. And I was working in the College Dublin, and they have the Irish Folklore Center there.
And the Book of Kells.
Yes,
Sorry.
no, that's not in that. It's at
Oh,
Trinity.
you're right. It's at
Yeah,
Trinity in
so.
Dublin. I got too excited. I got too excited.
You're just that was a trick question. I know what you were doing. So,
Sorry, I get really excited about the Book of Kells. That's like my one. I can't wait to
it is
see it.
not your one thing that you get excited about.
You're right. I get excited. I'm an exclamation mark that just has vocal cords.
So anyway, what they did was they collected stories from the survivors, and they were on these wax cylinders, and then somebody transcribed them, and some were in translated into English, and others were in Irish. And so I was fortunate that I was able to work my way through the Irish ones with the help of a little dictionary too. And so those became the primary voices in that book. And yes, it is a sad story, a deeply affecting story, especially when you realize that famine is never about food. It's about who has access to food. And there was food in Ireland.
And that's
And
certainly playing out today as well.
it's playing out today. It's playing out in many ways, like healthcare. We have an abundance of healthcare in our country. It's access to it. And so that was my big takeaway from that book. I also knew that I wanted the voice that I wanted to start the story in, because The Irish people are so for their folk tales and their storytelling, and that's the voice that I started with. And the one story in that book that I love talking about is Bridget O'Donnell and how she was evicted. She was sick with the fever because that's what happens, typhoid, it was just spreading. She was sick with the fever. She had a 14-year-old son. She had two daughters. She was pregnant, 7 months pregnant with a baby. And because she couldn't pay the rent, the landlord sent men to tumble the cottage. So to evict her, and not only that, but to destroy the cottage because then he could raise sheep.
Oh my
And
gosh.
so I love talking about that story because when I mention the story to readers, history is as much about who's in the story as much as who's left out of the story. And so I asked college students a couple weeks ago, like, all right, who's missing in this story? And it took them a bit. And finally they realized, like, well, where's the husband or the father? I said, yeah, like, how do we know he was there or most likely there? Well, she's pregnant. And all those students were so funny. They just made me laugh out loud. And that became, now Bridget was, what happened as a result of the eviction is that she gave birth to a stillborn baby. The 14-year-old son died, and so now she has two children and she's sent to the workhouse. So that's this kind of story. Like, I'm thinking, what happened to her? What happened to her? So as I'm continuing my research, I'm trying to find this trail, and the trail goes dead because the papers at the one workhouse had been burned in a fire. And so then I think, now wait a minute, where could the father be? What, is he dead? Is he out looking for work? Is he trying to find food? Or, like many Irish people, did he end up in Canada or the States? And so I looked in the famine ship manifest, and sure enough, I found Bridget O'Donnell and two daughters who came and landed at New York City at Ellis Island. And anyway, so what we can assume, I can't say 100%, is that the father was here and sent money for their passage. And so I like looking again at people who have lived through or experienced very difficult experiences, and how what they did to hold on to hope, what they did to survive. And then there's the story of the man who carried the seed potatoes in his pocket and didn't eat them because he was hopeful to be able to plant them in the spring.
That
So,
kind of determination when you are hungry.
yeah.
I was making dinner early today, and it was, I normally have a snack at 3 o'clock, and I'm like, well, I'll skip that today because I'm going to be making shrimp tostadas later. I did not succeed. I had my power bar anyway.
You failed the
Yeah.
marshmallow test,
I
is
failed the
the
marshmallow test hard.
Yeah, it's it and it's the other thing is, it's emotional tension is what drives the story and so what makes the reader want to turn the page. And for me, that emotional tension also came when I'm thinking about my daughter went with me to Ireland, and she's a very good typist. And so I'm like, oh, this story, gotta type it out. This story, no, okay, type it out. And so,
You can come to Ireland with me. You type.
yeah,
I'll
I
ha
actually would be happy to do
I'm a
that.
handwriter, and I hate typing, so I'll just let Jen handle
That's
that.
fine.
And so what as we're traveling through Ireland and I'm looking out the window at all these sheep, I'm thinking, boy, those mothers who had to make a decision about which child to feed,
Yep.
Oh my gosh.
and you would feed the oldest child because it was the oldest child who could go out and
And
then
make
maybe get
money.
work and make money to bring it home. So that was that was the story of the research behind the book. And I then the illustrations, what I love about the illustrations, they're all contemporaneous from papers,
Yes, the
newspapers,
time period.
and I actually hired a photographer to, because you couldn't get all these images. And so I hired a photographer because the copyright, they're public domain, to take photographs of the images that are in that book. And then it was a work for hire, so I paid him. And those became the images in the book. But it was funny because, all right, one of my best friends is Elizabeth Partridge, who is very well known for her nonfiction books. And I didn't know if it was a waste of money for me to hire this photographer. I'm like, well, I'm going to call Betsy, see what she said. Well, Betsy wasn't home, but her husband Tom was home. And so Tom is great to talk to. And I said to Tom, I said, yeah, this is why I'm calling. And I explained the Illustrated London News and the Pictorial Times and what I was hoping to do. And I said, I just don't know about the quality. And he assured me, he goes, you know, I used to look at those newspapers. I think it was at his grandfather's house. And he goes, yes, they will be fine. And I'm like, okay. Thank you, Tom, for reassuring me. But that's what writers do. Like we have friends that we rely on to, you know, to help us along the way. And they're writers tend to be very generous people, I think. At least those are the ones that I've encountered.
That's wonderful. Yeah, because the images in that in your book are yeah, they're incredible, and there's so many of them. And it does a great job illustrating it.
And they also serve as sort of a counterpoint to the sadness because they're very sentimental, clean, sterile in a way. And so they serve as an emotional counterpoint to the story. And just to add that, I ended up donating all those images to the Irish Folklore Department.
Oh, that's
I
wonderful.
bet you they were very grateful. They were very happy about it.
Oh, as someone who has had to find images for museum panels and other illustrations, that is a gift to have free access to good quality images.
Going back briefly to the discussion about being frank with children about the ugly parts of history, in what ways has your dedication to that principle helped your career? And have there been any ways that it's hindered it, for example?
How I describe it is this: I like to shine a light on those dark, on those areas in history because I think that there is a gap between the guarantees and the promises of our own declaration and the Constitution
Well
and
stated.
those words and our actions. You know, we are a work in progress. We have not arrived, I don't think. And, you know, I think that by sharing these stories with young people, that it's not only important for them to know that, because we all encounter times in our lives where we think, well, that's not fair. And I find that young people are very much, they're social and political beings, and they can access the political systems in their lives. They can help transform. You know, because they're young, they don't like it, of course. I don't like it when life isn't fair. And they want to fix it. And sometimes they can't fix it themselves, and they need the help of adults. They need the help of books to help them understand this. And so I think that's important for them to know that we are a work in progress, and there's a lot of hard work yet to do ahead of us.
That's the truth.
So has it ever happened where it's been difficult for me? More recently, the last 2 years, 3 years, my book, They Called Themselves the KKK, has been the subject has been on the list of challenged books and banned books. And so it's has it, you know, it's hard because it's your book and you think, well, that's affecting me, but it's affecting readers. It's affecting their constitutional right, the First Amendment right. And so that's who it is affecting. And it's infuriating to me. Some people say, oh, is it sad? No, it's infuriating to me that we would want to revise, reshape, lie about our history
Absolutely.
because we're not doing justice. Our readers are young people, and we're also not honoring our own constitution then.
Yeah. I think that's such a valuable like thing to keep in. We are very avidly anti-book banning, you know, where we love delving into these difficult topics. And I, as a kid who grew up on this, you know, Dear America book series, that's what I loved about that series was that it wasn't shying away from these tough topics, and that it allowed me to learn about these periods in history in a way that wasn't sanitized. And I mean, it was to a certain extent, and we've talked about areas in which these books could have gone further.
Yes.
But
Very.
just the just the exposure to kind of a more complex, nuanced view of history, I think was incredibly valuable to me as a kid, and as, you know, someone who went on to make history my career. Is just that, because I think a lot of the frustration for adults now who have been having to learn the real history through things like the 1619 Project and, you know, the real history of Christopher Columbus, there's a real sense of kind of betrayal about like, well, this isn't how I learned it. And I think we are doing future adults that disservice when we coddle children and we teach them this sanitized version of history, because they're going to grow up and they're going to hear the truth and they're going to feel upset and betrayed that, you know, this isn't what I learned.
Yeah, it's certainly something that I went through. When you think you know something and then you are dead wrong, you are super wrong. It is hard.
Two things that you just said. One is learning, you learn your history, a sanitized version of history. And I think of this, makes me think of, and the danger that that presents to adults then, okay? I think of the psychologist Howard Gardner, who says when we encounter new information, we revert to what we knew as 5-year-olds. And you know, that happens when I was interviewing a man for the Hitler Youth book who had been in he had been drafted into the German army, and his brother actually gave up, Helmut Hubner gave up his life because he stood up to Hitler. He was 17 and he was executed. But when I was interviewing his brother Gerhard, he began to tell me how World War II started, and how and it was the lie that he had been told. And then he stopped and he corrected himself. He said, no, that's not right. And then he gave the correct version, the true version of what happened, and not what Hitler told them that happened. And I found that so interesting that he first reverted to what he had been taught, a drill. And then he realized, no, wait a minute. And that's a whole, and that is harmful to, I think, adults if they can't make that. Or if they're unwilling to learn the truth. The difference, I think, between a book for children and a book for adults is the degree to which we go into. Like if you look at any of my nonfiction books, or any of my even my fiction books, you can find every single subject that is in the book in an adult book. But the difference is the degree to which a writer might go in, you know, into that. Getting back to growing up in cold country, when I first went to Binghamton University, I met with the history professor, and he was very excited because he already had a copy of Growing Up in Cold Country. And he picked up the book and he said, "You know, this book is good enough to be in a book for to be a book for an adult for adults." And my eye started to twitch. I said, "Actually, they're anatomically." Books for young readers and books for adults are the same. And I said, if anything, a book for young readers has to be even better, given the audience, has to be even better
It
than.
certainly has to have better vocabulary.
Yeah,
And I don't mean tight, like I don't mean like, ooh, don't use the swear words. I mean like
no.
some of the words that adults use are quite lazy, and kids are excited for new words.
And you know, and speaking of vocabulary, you know, it's. Kids get most of their vocabulary by the age of 12 from their reading. After the age of 12, the way that people, kids increase their vocabulary is through study. So we really want to get them young and introduce them to all those words.
I love talking to you. Really reminded me, because I haven't been around kids in 5 years, which is when I stopped teaching, and like I feel very misty and wisty.
It's making me passionate about teaching kids, and that's something I've never wanted to
Yeah,
do.
you're not into kids as a general rule.
But I think it's something that I think is so important, which is one of the reasons why I'm too scared to do it, I think. And I've done a little bit of museum work for kids, and I have had the experience of writing at a lower grade level, and it's really hard.
It is.
And to know like which concepts you need to slow down and explain, and
Word selection. Yeah.
So it's
Yeah. You mentioned being too scared to do it. And just let me assure you that no matter the age, they can't kill you. But if they do, they're not allowed to eat you.
Okay. Well,
Okay?
I feel like that's what I'm less worried about.
Okay, you and I know very different breeds of children because
You
the
know
ones
biters.
I knew could definitely take me and would consider eating me.
Yeah.
You got the biters, second grade, right? Biters.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Eighth graders will just ruin you
That's
socially.
what I'm more scared of
Yeah.
is the just evisceration of by words.
Well, I have a story for you about
Oh,
that.
wonderful.
Because you used the word cool before, and I remember I had already been teaching, several years, and I was using the chalkboard, and a student, he didn't even raise his hand, he shouted out, and he said, "Hey, Mrs. B, so what kind of music do you listen to?" And I'd been teaching long enough to know, don't answer that question. Because no matter what music you listen to, it's not the right music. You are not cool. And so I remember putting the chalk down and I said to him, "Look, if you're trying to figure out how cool I am, I never have been cool, never will be cool, never want to be cool. I'm the most uncool teacher you will have ever had." And he left the classroom and he did that thing with the finger, pointing.
Like
And
a
he
little
said,
Fonzie.
"Hey, Mrs. B, you're cool."
Aww.
You just know it's a trick question.
Yeah.
When Jen and I met, people, we were like building a new group of friends, and they would try and suss out what kind of music I listened to, and I would always just say like, "I'm not cool. I've never been cool. I don't listen to cool people's stuff." And I think that is part of the reason Jen decided to be my friend.
Yeah, because I am also not cool.
It worked out great for
No,
us.
not cool. My daughter asked, I was talking to her, she's a fifth grade teacher, and I was talking to her the other day, and she said, "Mom, if I order," she placed an order for so much makeup, she gets a free mascara. "Did you know," she said, "if I order this by Thursday, I get a free mascara?" And I said, "Did you know adult squirrels will use their tails as an umbrella during a rainstorm?" Was our conversation.
I'm sorry. Well, I'm telling you information.
That's a pure delight.
Yeah, you got to do the hand with the. Oh gosh. And then I was packing. I was speaking down in Florida and we were driving down. So I was trying to decide what to pack. And she said, "Well, you're only going to be, you're speaking one night and you're driving. It doesn't matter how much you pack because you got the car." I said, "Yeah, you're right. I probably don't need the printer." And I was serious. And I said, "Because the last time when I took the printer, your dad opened the back of the car and the printer fell out and landed on the pavement." And I'm texting and there's nothing. I go, "Brandy, Brandy?" She goes, "I'm still stuck on the word printer." So,
Nothing
yeah.
quite like overpacking.
I know. I feel like
Oh.
this interaction you had with your daughter is like you cares. I'm much more like your daughter.
You know what, though? The whole world needs balance,
Yes,
guys.
exactly.
Yeah.
Oh,
But I
okay.
enjoy it. I love it. It's
Yeah, we've been together for 12 years now.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
Going back briefly to the Irish potato famine, one of them.
Oh, yes.
Do you have any other books on that subject, audiobooks, traditional books, articles, anything that you would recommend to people who are further interested? Like if they got the taste with black potatoes, what should they read next?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, that's a stumper for me.
We can come back to it.
Okay, because are you thinking about like Irish history?
Or am I?
About in general, because I mean, I'm into like anything that Eric Larson has written.
Oh, yeah, I love him.
Yes.
Yeah, he writes about history. I'm really into anything that, what is his, Cillian Murphy? Is that his name?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Was just an Oppenheimer. What is his
No,
name?
You're correct.
Yeah, I was just maybe a little lustier. That is perhaps appropriate.
She let
for
out
this
an
podcast.
Inappropriate noise.
What did she say?
She just went.
Just, oh yeah, yeah. So whew, you know, man. Like anything that he's in, and you get to listen to that that accent, mm-hmm. that brogue, his brogue. Mm.
Slide right off the couch.
Stop! You can't say that on this podcast.
I'm sorry. In the other podcast, I was allowed to say whatever I want.
Had to rein you in a little bit.
As far as podcasts go, like I really just get interested in anything by Brené Brown and, Mel Robbins and Dax Shepard. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy those. Mm-hmm. But see, that's just when I'm trying to leave my work behind.
Yes.
And I want something that's going to let me think about something else for a little while.
Totally yes. fair. If you think of anything else later and you're like, shoot, I can't believe I forgot that, feel free to email it to us. And we like to compile book recommendations for folks for every book. So this is...
Okay, so you want recommendations for... this podcast is focused on black potatoes. So recommendations... that might further somebody's for further reading.
Yeah. If people are interested, we always like to, again, I like to be able to make book recommendations and just like give somebody the right book.
Good. Okay. Like, as I said, I blanked out on it, but I will come back to that.
Yeah. We've got all the time in the world. Sort of. What are we at for recording time, love?
We're closing in on 50 minutes, so maybe
one more?
Yeah, one more question, and we can wrap it up.
I'll save some of my questions about your career generally for in case you come back in the future.
Yeah.
Because I have a feeling we're going to see you like two or three times.
I'm happy to. Yeah.
I love you too. Let's be best friends and get tattoos. And then you have to meet our other best friend, Aubrey, who was the last person who interviewed with us.
Just adding to our friendship bracelet list.
Oh, nice.
Isn't that nice? That makes me happy. Maybe we are secretly cool. That's what we're learning.
Wow.
Right? We're popular girls now.
What's the next question?
I don't know. You can't just let me be in charge. Oh, what are you working on right now? And what can we look for from you in the future?
Okay.
If anything.
Yeah. I'm hoping that I'm going to be selling a novel that I just submitted. It's a middle grade novel and it's out of my wheelhouse.
Mm.
So that's actually all I'm going to say about it right now.
How tantalizing.
I know. You will be the first to know if it gets picked up. And then I'm also researching and I will tell you what I'm researching. I'm researching an English artist by the name of Mary Delaney, who invented collage art.
Cool. Wonderful.
And she was born in 1700 and died in, I think it was 1789. But, so she's a member of the Blue Stocking Group.
Yes.
And so these women used to, they had portable microscopes. Like they so wanted to learn. It was, you know, the age of enlightenment, and they so wanted to learn about science and botany and the natural world. And so this Blue Stocking group had, they all had their own portable microscopes. And so, you know, like we would get together today for maybe a reading group, a book group. They would have their little microscope group.
Cool.
And so I'm interested in that, but also because of how they broke, or she in particular broke so many of the assigned gender rules of the time. Sometimes she would adhere to them, and then other times, like, she would break them. And so I'm just interested. I'm interested in that.
Yeah, that sounds.
Frida Kahlo kind of picked up where she left off, maybe. Right? Sort of a art collage. Kahlo did some collage.
Did she?
Just while she was sick, after she got hit by the bus.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, Frida. Yeah. She, yeah, her paintings are just, her life is just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, so that's just, you know, I'm interested in that subject because she invented the art as she was moving through the grief of losing a much loved husband. And so, again, it's, you know, are kids interested in that? I think so, because I think kids live through, you know, sad times as well. And, need to know, it's that whole e-agency again. We're getting back to that. So, anyway, that's where I'm at. And for the first time in my life, I do write poetry. And for the first time in my life, I participated in a poetry reading yesterday.
How'd that go?
Well enough. It went well enough. I'm in love with what, you know, one of the poets did and how she, you know, it was really, it was like an acting class, you know, it was amazing. It was just amazing. So Nicole Caruso, and I know she has a third name, but I know Nicole Caruso, I really liked her work.
Right. Do you ever follow, it's on social media. I get clips and stuff on Facebook and TikTok, but it's a group that does stand-up poetry readings called Button Poetry.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I recommend it highly.
Okay, writing it down.
Yeah, some of their poems are really, really great. And then I can't remember, I have the collected works of one of them, and the book is called Fat Girl Finishing School.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Oh, it's so good. And every time I need to feel like I'm angry, but I don't know why, I'll read through, because, you know, it's only like 50, 60 pages. So read through while I'm doing dialysis or something. And then I get off the needles just full of rage. And like, it's like that tapped in feminine rage. And I'm going to go do something about it. And
that's,
I always feel a little
better. I love that that's what you feel when you're getting off. Instead of feeling beaten down, or that's the emotion that floods.
There was a time when dialysis was a lot harder on me, when it was new and I didn't know what was happening. But we do dialysis here in my home, my husband and I, and we do it 5 days a week instead of three. So it is a lot. And if I were mad about it every day, I wouldn't have energy for anything else anymore. And I don't have the attention span to be angry about things for long. I get distracted. So, yeah, I think there was a time when I was angrier and sadder and more tired. And now sometimes I just can focus that rage into something productive. But for the most part, I just ignore it.
Like you'll focus on your literary adventures to come.
There you go.
Sometimes, yeah. I got really bored and I wrote half a book of poems.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. The the word I was looking for with Nicole's work was performance. Performance. I said acting, but it's performance. She just did a an amazing job. So
I'm picking up what you were laying down. I was right there with you. Yeah, I would love to see that.
Yeah, good.
Well, this has been truly wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
You have been a wonderful, marvelous, very generous guest, and thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you so much for reaching out and for being patient with me. So till next time.
Yes. Till next time.
Wonderful. All
right. Okay.
That was our wonderful conversation with Susan Campbell Bartoletti. She was a pure delight.
Seriously.
What a wonderful person to talk to. She wrote a fantastic book. She wrote many fantastic books. We highly suggest that you seek them out.
Especially the Dear America titles.
Yes. Well, that one is, the two are still to come. So stay tuned for those. And we would love to have Susan back to talk about a book that she wrote for Dear America. But stay tuned for that. In the meantime, our next book is...
I Thought My Soul Would Rise and Fly, yes. The Diary of Patsy, a Freed Girl.
Yes. So
which focuses on the Reconstruction era from 1865 to 1867. I think it's... girl, there's a whole lot about that.
Yeah, so I started dipping into that book today and realized that I don't think I ever read that one when I was young. So this is a new experience for me. Very excited to dive into that with you.
Yeah, I finished our reading for the first half mm-hmm. Sunday, and I really enjoyed it. I think this mm-hmm. is one of the better Dear America books. Mm-hmm. But I'm excited to start my side reading. Mm-hmm. I got a fat book about the Reconstruction.
Wonderful.
Real big. It's wonderful.
So we will talk about that book and all of your side reading in a fortnight.
Fortnight.
We'll see you then.
Bye, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening. We'd like to thank Erica Page for creating our amazing intro and outro music, Callie Cheering for being the best research librarian we know, and the world's best editor, Danny Heck. Feel free to reach out to them with contact info in the description.